So what did I want to say? I wrote a one-page paper on this false root business. So there are two levels to think about it. One is sort of a bit social. Is it right to do it? Is it whatever? And the other is just purely technical. So this is just at the technical level. It's only one page, so actually I was hoping that people will read it. Yeah, one double page, double-sided page. Actually, in the printed, I don't know. I think it's two pages. Yes. No, this is the preprint. No. Okay. As I see it, and I didn't spend much time thinking about it, so I may be wrong. I see two classes of things that have been written criticizing the false root. One is this paper by Janssen and many other people, in which they said that in order to they observe that this is correct, and then they say that this is bad. Now, this doesn't prove that the falsehood is bad. Okay, so I don't know. I don't think that that paper, that criticism, is hitting the right point. The right point. Now, there are more. There is another set of papers that I've seen which are dealing with the free theory. As far as I understand them, and I'm open to corrections, is what they do is they look at the determinant, and they say that it is a sort of a product over B, goes from 1 to 16, and then you have some function of B of the P twiddling that measured from the center. It doesn't really matter. And now each one of these Fs sort of has a single zero and it represents a particle. And then you try to mark it up to find some approximation. But there's no B dependence on the functional structure itself, only on the argument. Now to me this looks kind of guaranteed to work. Because what you do, you just take a function, it has a zero, it has some behavior, and you try to find some other function which will do the same thing. So clearly the formation will be analytic in p squared around p squared equals zero. And if that is true, then it is local. And there is no need for heavy words. I mean, analytic in p squared is just as good as local.
I would say for the free theory, it almost has to work. Because
yeah, that's what I agree.
The spectrum of the fermion doesn't depend upon the other fermions, right? Any particular fermion is only dependent. And it's only when they start interacting with each other.
Absolutely.
Something gets screwy. So
absolutely.
I think you may be able to prove it for the free case. But.
So therefore, I'm not. So these were against. But they didn't really go prove any much against. And these were four. And these didn't prove anything for four. And then there are two arguments that we see four in the so more four. And one argument says, look at the numbers that come out and compare them to the unquenched numbers, and you have this pretty plot that are numbers scattered around the line, and they, you know, get an order and fall in line. And, you know, that there's nothing to argue with that, okay? That's not enough for doing, I think, really numerical QCD, because our ultimate objective is to have a tool that produces a number that if it does not agree with the experiment, we say that we have discovered new physics, and we can't do that with a false root. Now there is another argument. So this was what is it called, the Lepage plot, or okay.
called the ratio.
Ratio.
Okay, so this is how I solve it in Unix. And two, there is the argument that ghosts and bosons work. This argument I don't buy. So this is, I think, this is an X. Because the real problem is an ultraviolet problem. And we know that there are non-local systems which will obey Carl Lagrangian behavior. We have explicit examples from string theory. No, there's nothing to argue there because there are explicit examples of things which are not field theories, have an infinite number of particles.
Why do you say it's not
the KS? Yeah. Well, I think it's a problem for normalization. I will show you.
Well, I find somebody say ghosts and bosons, anybody would say ghosts and bosons work, so they don't work.
What?
No.
The claim is, as I understand it, and is that you can write an effective Lagrangian guided by symmetry principles, and then you can look at and Steve knows it better than me, and then you look at what comes out from the numerical simulation, and it more or less seems to be explainable by that, and that the assumption underlying that effective Lagrangian is that indeed you have just one species rather than, you know, you have one species split off in the right way.
I think you give it a bit too much credit because it's not an effective Lagrangian approach. You start off with one. For staggered fermions without the full three term, you have everything pushing under control.
Right.
And then you, in the effective Lagrangian, you put in by hand back this quarter.
Okay.
So it's not an effective Lagrangian. Butchering the effective theory
no.
The way, which is entirely analogous to the way you're
yes.
So, to my mind, the argument is it gives you a functional form with some motivation which mocks up what you think's going on, which smoothly goes, has a smooth limit as A goes to zero. And that limit is what you want.
Yeah,
so well, the number of flavors. So is there
data all a partially quenched Carl perturbation theory to
not that I know of, no. You can't, not starting with a Lagrangian.
No, but what I meant to say is, even if you got the right Goldstone boson structure, so you start with force root, you do all kinds of, you do a much better simulation than today possible, let's say, and you measure enough processes that you get relations between the parameters, then you guess an effective Lagrangian somehow for describing this Goldstone boson. So the mere fact that you can represent the interactions with a limited number of parameters, L to L10, and suppose you measured 100 processes, so lots of non-trivial relations would be satisfied. Even then, that would not prove that the force root is right, because I admit that this is a bit intuitive on my side, but I feel that the problem is really an ultraviolet issue.
I really don't understand why you think it's ultraviolet. I think if there's a problem, it's really has to be in the infrared. Because if you're accepting the free theory works, I don't see how you're going to make a strong argument that the ultraviolet with some infrared cutoff, so the theory is essentially perturbative, it's going to fail. If you start with the point case theory, which should be okay, then the ultraviolet thing, you think asymptotic freedom works, so you can do perturbation theory to understand the ultraviolet. And then putting the fourth root before all of the fermion hoops is exactly what you need to reduce the number of the.
I think about, okay, I'll give you an example of, maybe I first will explain what I did here, then you will understand why I think it is ultraviolet. how should I say it? It's a little bit similar to chiral fermions. So it's ultraviolet but non-perturbative, okay? I don't have a better way of saying it. The real problem is that you do not have any tool that I know of that sort of you start with this force root and you apply to it, you know, rules of ordinary field theory, and you get that it is a normal theory. Okay. We all know that if you take the log of the determinant and you put the force root, that looks like, you know, having an NF divide. So you can do it from an arbitrary NF, and then, you know, there is a factor of NF in the exponent. When you write the determinant as the exponent of something, there's a factor of NF there, and you can sort of divide it out. But that's too naive. That doesn't take into account the fact that there are non-perturbative effects. And the ultraviolet completion of QCD could be something else, could be non-QCD-like. And the force root may be providing you something like that. That's my feeling. Okay. So I was asking myself, what would make me happy? What kind of a, so I think everybody should ask, what kind of a proof would make you happy? I mean, that the force root is right. Pardon me?
A real proof.
Well, yes, but. But the.
Actually, on the other hand, what would make me happy if someone uses this would be a real proof from the other side instead of.
Okay, this takes us to the social issue, which of course everybody feels much stronger about, his own view. I do not think that the burden of proof is on the rest. I think the burden of proof is on the people who use it, absolutely, without doubt. Because you can, this is not a problem in nature, okay? It's not a problem of physics to figure out what a force root does. This is a problem which is caused by, I don't know, by an evolutionary process in science. If you wish. But the people who do it are bear the responsibility to sell it. I worked 10 years on a physics problem of chiral problems. I'm not going to invest 10 years in thinking about the force root. No, really, honestly. Nobody else would do it except somebody that is committed to that program. I think so. So.
I think
all right. So we have, but I don't want to get to the social. So what is the problem technically? So how did we? So let's think Pauli Vilas. How do you regulate something that you don't like? You preserve locality and you throw away spin statistics, for example. So you have a determinant to the force, and you say if this force, okay, were an integer, nobody would complain. So you look for a representation with gn's which are integers. Okay. So you need the sum over gn's, integers, to be equal a quarter. And clearly a convergence sum will not do it, but 1 over 1 plus x, you know, for x equals 1 gives you a half. So if you can do a half, you can do a quarter. And the way to do a quarter is to take a derivative of that. Okay, so you take the derivative of a geometric series, and that's what you get. And you see your answer is that you will put in fields, an infinite number of fields, one for each n. At each n, you will have n fields, so it's actually a quadratically growing number of fields. And according to n, they will be bosonic or fermionic. Okay? And then, when you think about it, so clearly this, since it's a quadratic infinity, it hints you that there are two extra dimensions. I mean, it's an infinite space, so you think what is the familiar way of a physicist to think about it. So you think about it as a two-dimensional space. And then you ask what? Pardon me?
Hold on a minute. For every n, I've got a different number of flavors in some sense. But the gauge fields depend on the number of flavors. And so.
No. Ks is parametrically dependent on the gauge field.
The gauge fields depend on how many fermions I got there. And it's just really very circular, right? I mean, the important gauge fields are very, very different when there's fermions there and when they're not there.
At the end of the day, you have some. I've not proven anything. All I'm saying is that if you have a set of gauge fields, you make out of them a quadratic. Look,
the gauge fields are completely different.
I'm looking at an arbitrary U.
There are important gauge configurations, and there's ones which are up there which are never important. Like the most important gauge configuration is always the one where all the U's are one. But that has no entropy.
But I'm not making any assumption about you.
Proof doesn't need to be an efficient simulation
problem. All right. No. Wait, let's not miss the main logical point. U is an arbitrary gauge configuration here.
Most likely gauge configuration is all U's being one. Okay, that's fine.
But I'm giving you more. I'm giving you a formula for any U.
But each term in this series is dominated by a different set of U's.
That's what I meant by is proof not needing to be an efficient simulation.
No. There is no proof yet. There is no proof. But I think that I'm trying to make a logical point, which is so how to think. And the one thing that we exploit, both in the trick and in the solution, is that fermions appear only bilinearly in the action. We couldn't do it with a field that doesn't appear bilinearly in the action. Because it appears bilinearly in the action, we can do exactly what we can do it for arbitrary U. Okay? And this is exactly the same technique that you can do it for chiral fermions. It's very similar in logic. So, and it is done for arbitrary gauge fields. So that's not the weakness of this. The weakness comes later. Okay. Now, when you...
Can you have the determinants or inverse determinants?
That's necessary. That is just like in Pauli-Villars. Right? Just in Pauli-Villars, you replace the propagator by a 1 over sum over propagator, you have alternating signs in the residues. So this is, this is a regularization. The objective of this regularization is to sort of set something up that the system can pick its own low degrees of freedom, so you don't fall in the trap of taking here, speaking, here you force something on the system, which, I mean, this is a little thing you were doing, and now you do a barbaric thing. So here you leave it to pick its own degrees of freedom, but clearly, you're cheating at this point because you are going to manipulate infinite series, so you will have to regulate it at some point, and that's where, that's where the problem will appear. But technically, it looks pretty. Because this is the degeneracy which is associated with two dimensions, if you teach angular momentum, m goes from in two dimensions is just linear. So if you have an angular momentum degeneracy, it's easy to make so this Hamiltonian, which is a harmonic oscillator in two dimensions, will have this spectrum of energies, and the sign can be associated with the intrinsic parity of that Hamiltonian. So you have sort of a way of defining it. So therefore, you say, I'm now thinking about simulation, or not as well, a definition of an action which has still some arbitrariness, because the single thing that is bad about this action is that it has an infinite number of fermions. But other than that, nothing else. This is pretty bad, but that's it. What? No, that we will deal in a moment. Actually, formally not, because formally, if you calculate here the induced action on the A mu's in perturbation theory, then what would you do? You would calculate for each n, and you would use just this formula, and this formula will just give you the right answer.
It's related to the fact that we use
to leading order. No. There's no question that this is bad, but let's not put the illness where it's not. So, to leading order in the computation of beta naught, all you have to add is this diagram. Okay? And here, whatever the sum over these guys will give you the sum over Gn, which will be a quarter. So, there's nothing. So, at least perturbatively, I'm preserving what you like. Okay, so it's not like I'm, you know, screwing up asymptotic freedom. Okay, now, non-perturbatively, indeed, I will have to control this, and I will give them heavy masses, and then they will not, then they will non-perturbatively be decoupled and allow for asymptotic freedom up to getting there. So basically, so there's a degeneracy, which is just this Gn. I see I have a bug, so I should put absolute value. So all I have done is added lots and lots of more Kogut-Saskin fermions with right statistics and wrong statistics. That's it. Okay, and whatever KS you want, you can use. There. Alpha is just because I have to get this n, so I have the degeneracy. So n is the energy of the Hamiltonian. Now, clearly, what do? You have to control the sink and the way you would control it is to put some masses. Because think about this calculation, still perturbatively, you will have loops, and each loop is a trace. In addition to being a trace on all other things, it is also a trace on this internal space. And then I want that trace is a sum over n. And I need to control it. So one way to controlling it is to give masses to the higher guys, which I can do if I put a function of h. H is n. So this will control it. And then I will have a whole issue of limits. And the real problem why I say ultraviolet is how to, so clearly when lambda goes to zero, I get back to my former situation. When lambda is big, then I have all the higher guys decoupled. I make f of zero, zero, so it doesn't affect the low guy.
So lambda, you get just a single
four component. And if it were just lambda, it wouldn't be so bad, but I have to, it's the interplay between the limits, little a goes to zero and lambda goes to infinity, that where the problem is buried. So that's the reason I said what I said at the beginning, that I think it's an ultraviolet problem. The one thing that is not here in this paper is a hidden thing that I know from other experience. Yes, I was at the self-imposed page limit. So, this is a brief report, so I could have gone as much as but what I have in mind is something. Okay, so you know that you can make things on defects. Everybody knows that you can make them on a wall, but you can also make them on a defect which is codimension 2. And then it looks like a string from the point of view of the two dimensions. Okay, so what you put is a Higgs field which has sort of a rotational synthetic, and if it goes out to infinity, then it forces a zero mode on this, with definite chirality. Now, You know that this is always a problem when you implement it because it has to go out to infinity. We always compactify it. Now, you may remember the walls were compactified. So you had, the way you compactify the walls, there was only one more directions, and that was the compactification, right? So you had a wall and an anti-wall, and that separated. So that took an intelligent square root of the Dirac. I mean, it was a holomorphic square root. That was the problem for a wild fermion. It's basically taking a holomorphic square root, holomorphic meaning that it has a nice dependence on the gauge fields as viewed as complex variables. And so suppose you do that now in this setup. So when you compactify, you will get not a circle, but a torus. And if I draw, so this is the two-dimensional extra space. If I draw this torus, you will not be surprised, because we all know about fermions, that there are four images. And actually, what happens is that here you get just a doubling. But in this case, the natural compactification gives you a fourfold thing. So actually this, oh, is this clear what I'm saying? It's not.
Not really, but keep going. But if the outcome is that you get four times as many fermions,
so,
as you want, I could believe it.
So that the point is that if you use two extra dimensions, you naturally get a fourfold degeneracy when you compactify for the zero modes. All right, so again, if space-time is two-dimensional space is infinite, then you can make a thing at the center, a zero mode just at the center. And it is, and its partners are ruled out because of integrability when you go in either one of the directions. Now you compactify it this way and that way, and the natural thing is that you will get all the images, which are four. So now I'm thinking not about just turning around the game and saying, forget about chirals and everything, just do it with Kogut-Saski, and it looks naturally that you will get, if there indeed are four fermions, one of them will drop on each one of these defects. That's, but that was too speculative to put in there. So, but that's the hidden, my hidden motivation to thinking that maybe there is a way of actually doing so. And yeah, I won't bore you. There's even, okay, one more sentence which would tax your patience. So you're in this case, to get just this guy, what did you have to do? You had to sort of think about the transform matrix going this way and then project on the vacuum. So the question is, what would you do in this way where you are fourfold guys? There's a very nice tool in statistical mechanics, which is called the corner transform matrix, which basically says, fix the boundary condition, something like that, sum everything inside. Think about this as a matrix. And then this partition function is like trace of K1, K2, K3, K4. But these are the corner transform matrix. Now this is analogous, if you think about it, is analog of saying that here you have a psi 1 and here you have a psi 2, which gives you the overlap. So I see a possible road in the sense that if one could, so the difference between these things would be the addition of an extra master which changes by phase to the Kogut-Saski. All right, so.
Can I try to rephrase it in this sense?
Sure.
If I understood you correctly, your speculation is that each one of those defects, one of the Kogut-Saski cases.
Right.
Sides, and that when you sort all this out with your interchange of limits of lambda and a, possibly discovering what the right ones would be, you would get rid of three of them and just be left with.
No, you would always have all of them, but they would factorize. Yes, you're right, sorry. Okay, so there are lots of ways to put in lambda dependence and do that. There is a lot of freedom in that. I mean, I have no idea which one. One possible way would be to invent this structure here in such a way that it is a structure that tries to put, which is analog. You see, it's a deformation just of the action, the extra two-dimensional part of the action that sits between the chi and chi. Okay, it's hidden in this thing, in the F. So F is a function of H, but F is some function, actually doesn't have to be just of H. It can be a function of Q and P, which has a property that preserves parity, so it preserves the distinction between the statistics, and sort of is big when the Hamiltonian is big. And I'm thinking about that, that I could use it just like the mass term was used here, you know, positive, negative. I could use it here, but here I would have to give it four phases. Then, so this is a finite system. You can think about the extra dimensions as lattice size, as far as I'm concerned. Also, so this has a finite number of fields. Okay, this is not yet the k to the quarter. However, it factorizes in the appropriate limit into four guys, and each one of them is represented then by this false root. Okay, that's the dream.
One basically run is that the fermions, because you have sort of pseudo-periodicity in these four cells, it seems.
Absolutely. You should think about
yeah.
this identified with this and this identified with this.
Situations where the fermion fields are actually not sort of periodic with respect to this four-fold symmetry, so that would score the factorization. So you have to be a little bit careful.
Okay. Yeah, it's true that there is no actual four-fold symmetry because I just said that I have to have a phase that rotates. That's correct. The boundary conditions that the fermions obey on this internal two-dimensional torus are periodic, that I know. Okay, I make them. I declare what they are. I mean, so it's up to me. It's not enforced on me. And if I declare them to be periodic, then I will get these mirrors. These mirrors are a result of the periodicity. So it is true that I was slightly lying because I ignore the fact that this is 1, 2, 3, 4. And I was speaking about as if they are the same, but they're not exactly the same. And I don't really know precisely, but I feel that they differ just by some phase or something which is not relevant, really. And therefore, essentially, each one of them is an KS to a force. Okay, but clearly, so this is what I, as an example, this is a long, it's an arduous process to set this up and actually check. You have to make an intelligent guess for this F, check that this works. Check it in perturbation theory always. Then check that sort of things like an instanton effect, for example, is really four-fold replicated. It has to be exact. Okay. You have to see, for example, you know that in a true false root will have a proportionality to m, not to absolute value of m in the determinant in a u, which is an instanton. This would probably come out that here it is m and here it is, you know, different phases, and many of the checks would have to be numerical because it's too hard. Even if it can be proven analytically, a perturbative calculation, in my experience, is much faster to just do it numerically first, see whether it's right. But it is a very long project to convince. But people who are doing the false root, and I have lots of sympathy in a way because it's taking a risk. I like people who take risks. You take a risk, but you have to, you know, taking a risk means you have to try to prove that. Sorry, I took much longer than I thought.
It's just that, let's go back to the right to say, we know it's actually wrong. I mean, the things that are propagating in the vacuum and not in the vacuum, and so that they're also being consistent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you actually measure that? I'm more of a measuring person than a mathematical physicist. And one way you can measure it that's very clear is you look at the flavor single sec, you look at the
let me call it eta prime. It's the thing which is the flavor single eta. In the real world, the eta prime is actually a mixture of the eta eight and eta one. You look at that, and the disconnected diagrams are completely wrong. You get a negative definite behavior. You know why we call unitarity or transfer matrix eigenstates are clearly the thing is a clear disaster. That's in quench. Now, if you want to check whether the fourth root is working, that's the place to check, because the thing has been cooked up to work for the connected correlators. It's been cooked up that the vacuum bubbles have got the factor four.
Right.
So, you know, that's what was done. It wasn't not being cooked up to get the flavor singlet separate right, in my opinion. And I find it scandalous that nobody working on this with all these lovely ratio plots has looked at a perfectly stable particle, which should be predicted perfectly accurately and should get got a perfectly good agreement. The only paper on this subject is Between These Walls Unreliable, the old Kilker paper. I mean, I've looked at it carefully, and it's an interesting paper, but I don't believe it's what I would call publishable.
It's to be recorded.
This is being recorded.
But you mentioned that it needs to be carefully monitored.
Let's put it this way, it never was published, right?
Yeah, I don't know the history of the paper. But thinking about it more theoretically, I do agree. I always look at, a picture of the diagram, and I see loops, and I see the lines that are connected to external lines, and it's clear that the lines that go out of the diagram are sort of where the problem may lie. That's what you're saying in a very specific case. But to be fair, there are claims that of seeing bunching up of eigenvalues of Ks in groups of four, which is
isn't necessarily good enough. I mean,
correct. Absolutely.
These eigenvalues in denominators as well as numerators, so at least for small eigenvalues. Have to worry about cancellation, which have to be much more precise than just the fact that the difference is going to
be. Absolutely. All I'm saying is that the fact that they bunch up is much better than if they didn't.
Sure. We knew they didn't.
Right. So.
What fields they even come close to matching the overlap? It's not. It doesn't prove it.
Right. I mean, in spite of the personal delight, I feel this is not necessarily a criterion. Everything is a regularization. The overlap butchers the theory still. I mean, and there is it's not necessary for the Kolbotsaskians to butcher the theory in a similar way, meaning the eigenvalues of the overlap on some rough configuration do not have to match up. So the KS operator could have eigenvalues with bunch up at values which are not equal to those of the overlap, and I wouldn't go to Kleiner corner. I mean, I wouldn't see that as a bad symptom, really. If you told me, however, that something happens with the density of eigenvalues near zero, where it is related to psi bar psi, or if you told me even worse that you don't find a regime where the density of eigenvalues goes like a k to the third, d3k with the right degeneracy, which I know is the thing that I have to get in order to get ultraviolet behavior, then I would worry. I mean, after all, there are lots of possibilities to define the overlap, and I'm sure they don't agree in great detail in the middle of non-their eigenvalues. But the bunching up, I agree, is a good sign. I mean, it's not a bad sign. Okay.
No, it's essential.
Right. Right. Now, I do think that Chris has one suggestion, but there is room for people to come up with specific sharp tests of different kind. I mean, I do have a mathematical inclination in my looking at things, but the question is for everybody the same. Is it right or isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
also, this problem is very closely related to the problem of Mike Kreutz, because, you know,
absolutely,
we discussed before that how you get out of something which has a zero mass, something which is has a non-zero mass at zero part mass. And this is exactly how it could be that you take, you know, the connected plus the disconnected, and the connected has something which goes to zero mass, so which is a very flat correlator.
Maybe you come.
Which is very flat, and then the difference which goes down, having rise to a mass which is non-zero. So I think this is exactly, and that is presumably where the problem is.
Well, maybe you want.
I mean, it's sort of what I was saying the other day.
Yeah. But maybe somebody else wants to say something.
I mean, in the context of what Chris was saying, the propagator between two purely gluonic operators in the quench theory, of course, has an exponential product, because two Boltzmann maps. In the four-flavored theory, you have a power law product, because the Boltzmann became the products. Somehow, when you go from four to one, you've got to change the power law product into a exponential product.
Yeah.
Where does that happen? How does that happen? It's disconnected back.
Right. So it looks like, I don't know, somebody who would, please go ahead.
I have one comment to Chris, one question. One is, I am doing the, with Shania and Kahneman doing the disconnected diagram based on the higher partition, but this time into the single pieces. We are arguing this so-called N-mod square connecting the loop diagram could be different from variance, and variance C and CC for the four-sleep case or any other instruction. And that derives the this difference of N-mod square derives the further pole, double pole structure in the, for example, algebra. And but the good news is the we think this difference is visible on finite data, but also very A0. We are sort of putting up the paper, and so there will be some text that is coming. Second question is, since we have this much people here, so, and if we are seem to convince that the force root has nothing, no problem in the propagation part of the theory, and I wonder if how can we be so sure about that? For instance, we have four groups, right? Four groups is up to A over time, right?
Maybe you come here to use the blackboard, and I have your chair.
Kill it, so
I can give you
a chair. No, the chair that was in the kill the deal. I knew. Should have said. A good negotiator doesn't disclose.
The question.
Well, maybe he's just saying there's no Lagrangian that you can start from, so how can we discuss it, you know?
He has something specific.
I thought. I want to make sure the is there any proof or paper that, you know, any graph of force root of a such kind is exactly the same as continuum? That would be my question.
No. There's no Rice theorem for this kind of thing.
Yeah, but now you ask on the level of theorem, just normal down-to-earth calculation. I mean, if you count the, you know, the vacuum polarization with Corbett-Suskind, you get the right answer, which is fourfold. Okay.
Right. Everything has been done once, but there's no proof.
Yeah, but what were you asking?
There's no proof to the standard of Rice's theorem. That's true, but.
Who cares?
In the continuum, people use things like the method of regions to argue that effective field theories exist in all orders in perturbation theory, and it's pretty clear that there are four regions in this, and it's pretty clear what the symmetries are, so I don't think
I do not know what you mean, but we can calculate the vacuum polarization kind of diagrams to the order we want. And isn't that Do we need more than that?
He's on the other side.
Right.
I just want to. I mean, he says it's okay.
Right.
More or less. Right. You didn't say it's okay? Oh, maybe it was so complicated I didn't understand.
So it's okay, okay.
No, I mean, there's only one method for fermions that, for which there is such a racial plot. So there's only one method for which we have that kind of evidence that you can actually do GCD. And so it is very interesting to try to do some other calculations, but it absolutely has to be settled one way or another. That is why I complained. You said the burden of proof is on the people who are for it, and I entirely agree with that. But there's a burden on the people against it, which is to make responsible arguments against it, and not ones that that are flimsy. I agree with what you said about the person example.
Well, a very responsible argument against it is the fact that when you bring more about change and stuff, and something you think is right, it's usually wrong.
No, there is no symmetry. If you claim there is a symmetry in terms of people should let it hang there, and believing it or not believing it is sort of equal probability. I don't think so.
I actually agree with Dave that we need a definitive answer, and it is everybody's responsibility.
But we're speculating
to a certain extent to help resolve it.
But on at a speculative level, if you assign chances, probabilities, is it right or wrong? I think the probability that it be wrong is higher than the probability that it be right, as we stand now. That's how I feel. Now, this is personal. This is not mathematical. I can't prove. This is probability. I mean, probability in theory space is done only in string theory or something. But I do think that it is sufficiently questionable that a person who says, I don't believe it just on general grounds, is sort of in a safer position than the person who says, this is right, and give me all the computer time for it.
Saying, I don't believe it because it's not proven yet.
No.
That statement is a different statement than.
Absolutely. Then what I mean.
It is wrong because I had a trivial comment.
Right. No, I made already the things that bother me. It would be nice if it were right. It's a cheaper way of doing sex. It would mean that we get faster there.
Right. There's one additional option which we haven't discussed, is that it would be, from a fundamental point of view, wrong, from a constructive point of view. But there might be safe quantities that are not affected by these problems. So then it becomes very important to understand exactly the underlying structure. Because then you can still work with it, and as long as you understand.
I wouldn't buy stock in that company if that were true.
But it depends on what you can do numerically. I mean, this is the reason people go to this, is because.
So for example, as you said at the beginning, people right away move the quarter to the right. The DET parts, and I would also say we're sloppy about the subscripts that should be on the determinant, whether it's one species or four, and then said that this operator, the fourth root, is bad.
Yeah.
And went and showed in great detail that it was bad.
Well, that was kind of
said it was obvious.
Yes, I agree.
And so there is this locality issue, which just has to do with the loops, and you could discuss it in blue ball, or you can discuss it in the Borkonium, and then you don't have the problem that Chris was talking about, like with the A prime, where there is something going, a unitarity violation, because somehow the loops and the lines would be treated differently.
Well,
and I think there's a good chance that the locality would turn out right, but then you would find effects like what Parker was talking about in unitarity, because you've used a consider different formulation for your groups and quantities. I think it's for sure that these effects will be there.
Because they will vanish in the
in your liver. Yeah, they kill you. It's a question whether the unitary violation will go away as A to zero in a way that
if the problem were sort of in a very precise sense only on external lines. I think one could do lots of things. I mean, for example, you could take just pops into my head, okay? So you have something you do like for the external lines, right? Some operators. You take those, you take the determinant of them, which it's very complicated to simulate, and all you have to prove that that determinant divided by the false root determinant. It's just a redefinition of the action. It's differs only in local terms. So you could go the other way around, right? You could, once you really sort of made peace with the heart of the matter, that the perturbative argument of taking a force, you know, is actually sustainable non-perturbatively, and there is no tricky business with the limit A goes to zero. Well, I would change the percentages of the risk. I mean, this is all. Because I can think of 100 tricks, not 100, but I can think of several tricks. The moment you tell me that all your problem is to find is what are the right observable, what are the right things to put on the external lines, okay?
We're not there.
We're not there even there. Right. So I don't know. But now there is one analogy to this problem, which is due to David Kaplan. I'll just mention it. It's an analogy, so don't jump on it immediately, saying it's not exactly true. I know, and he knows it's not exactly true. But somebody could look at in the continuum and hear that there is a problem with SU2 gauge theory with a single vial fermion. Say, forget it. I just take SU2 with a Dirac. There is no problem. I take the spherical. And you know that that would lead you to the wrong answer because the theory is right. Now, it's true, this is not chiral, and but it is an analogy. It's known that just looking at loops and putting one half or quarters is not a foolproof situation. Now, I'm not speaking ever anything really rigorous. I really care only about things whether they're true or false, not whether they're rigorously proven.
I really need to know it.
That issue you call actually is extremely interesting, and because If you wanted to do something like a standard model, we know how to do it if the vector act, make it a vector act. And so again, it's a case where you want to take a square root. And somehow the anomaly cancellation makes it possible, if the standard model exists on the lattice, which is still
no. No, standard model sort of evaded because it has an even number of
vectors. The square root is another problem. I mean, I can take
you don't need
pick domain walls and have a left handed.
Oh, you mean I don't.
And I want to take a square root to get rid of one of them.
Yeah, no.
You can't do that with the SU2. Maybe you can do it with some SU2.
Oh.
So that makes it very interesting.
No, SU2 is the more interesting problem because the fact that you cannot do it for something like SU3, for example, is obvious because there's an anomaly there which is perturbative, so you can immediately calculate it. What was baffling about SU2 was that the pseudo-real representation, no anomalies, And still, the thing looked totally impossible when you thought about putting it in an instanton, because who gets the instanton out of these two guys? And then eventually people saw that there was some non-perturbative thing. Now, I don't feel extremely strongly about the statement. I may be wrong when I say that it's all purely ultraviolet, because anomalies are tricky. Anomalies in one phasing are an ultraviolet problem, and then they have an equivalent phasing in which they are totally an infrared problem. So I'm aware that even that worry of my is worrisome. but I think there is lots of stuff doable. It's unsafe for us as a community to go out and say that we are there with the fossil. That I think is just unfair. I don't know how exactly to phrase it in a way that protects us from again having a situation in which we have to admit that we have been saying the wrong things. So we have to be conservative when we present what we say. Now, has anybody just done, the simple things like Koko Saskin with two parties, okay, so there's NF equals 8, and just see explicitly, numerically, the different beta function. This is a big difference in the beta function, the factor of 2 in Binah. Just see it with the naked eye on data. Show that indeed this theory has an SU8 cross SU8 flavor symmetry.
In a newer car, what is it? It's just the same factor, 1/4, is replaced by 2. That's the number 8 flavor. So
absolutely.
In algorithm sense, it's just changing one number.
That's why I'm asking.
Didn't Norman Preston?
Yeah, they
They were, yeah, but that was without doing improvements on the observables to
That's
see
right.
the taste restoration.
And he saw the
work. And it was also, is 10 years ago.
What is it that you wanted to use?
I would like to see two things. First, just the beta function, right? And second, the SU8 cross SU8 flavor. And there may be even a bit of physics, as we were talking sometime at lunch. If you add one more, then you may lose asymptotic freedom even before the beta function tells you. You may have a non-trivial fix from that. What I'm saying, trying to say, I don't want to insult anybody, is that maybe there are other things that one can do with the computer time to build a stronger basis for this, for the next, because nobody believes that in this year we will have such stuff coming out from this false root simulation that everybody will fall on his behind and say, wow, it's done. So even if you skip over a year and you wait until the computer, in 10 years, you probably will be able to do overlap or even. But so let's say you skip over a year and stagger and you wait until 3 years from now. In the meantime, you do something else. Maybe it's better. Maybe.
The experimentalists, we shall wait in also for some things and impatient.
Experimental? Okay. Yeah.
You really need to keep running the stagger, but then if you need substantial resources to check it. That's what we're doing. And that's basically the point.
Well, it looks to me that half will go just to doing straight false root, and I think that's the biggest fraction.
Okay, we can argue that it should be half or 30%.
Absolutely, it's a quantitative argument at the end of the day.
These
particular
people.
We're
talking about this
thing.
It's been done.
I know.
The only thing you have to be careful of is that they don't start to take the force move out of the orbit. <That's
right. laughs> Oh no! Actually, in my case, since it is below 1, it's good. Actually, we're 0.5. A force move of 0.5 is a pretty good number. Actually, I like that. You just gave me an increase. Yes, thank you.
I think that's a serious
Another thing was your time. Your time estimate is not measured, and say for thermodynamics, won't be able to do overlap for an next probably 40 years. Because you need until 20, 25, 30.
Well, there is really a difference in way of looking. I can't look that far. I'm sorry. I doubt it actually.
Well, there are good estimates by it. So.
Well, 10 years ago, I would have been totally unable to tell you how much it would take to do overlap. At all. It's just not predictable. I mean, what we know for sure, or what we have solid evidence, I think, is about 2010 or so that CMOS technology will work. So the computer time increase is sort of projected. I believe that estimate. I believe little else.
Well, if you look at the scaling of how much you need to go, I mean, if for thermodynamics, if you need to go twice in your latest space, and it's 2 to the 11th. So no Moore's law will help.
Yeah, I admit it could be that thermodynamics is a special case.
So at least for thermodynamics, computer time justify this stagger.
But
for spectroscopy, this is a very interesting question.
So, but I really think about something like epsilon prime over epsilon as an example of where potentially if we eventually get a number, we have to put a number so solidly on the table that when the experimentalists put their number near it, we can say we have proven that if they agree, then, people can go out to dinner. If they don't agree, we have discovered new physics, but we won't be able ever to make that claim unless we really, really shape up this force loop, and if we use the force loop.
Yeah, but Z is also done with domain one now, so epsilon prime.
I think epsilon prime is probably not the best example, because there's so many other issues and uncertainties.
I just want one example in which is a good case to
the unitary triangle opens up because of
fine unitary I just saw that epsilon prime over epsilon sort of a more obvious candidate for new physics, because then you need another source of CP violation, which is sort of a clean explicit thing.
Yeah, but it could be the same measurement, say, that a measurement of B sub K is inconsistent with the other.
Right, but I don't have immediately in my mind what kind of interaction you add. But is there an obvious candidate for the new physics which you have discovered? But in the epsilon prime over epsilon, there seems to be a more obvious candidate. So that's why I picked that example. It's, again, a very theoretical inclination. Okay, at 12:30 there is a seminar in Boyda in physics. If it's a string seminar by Soyoung Ray. And at 4 today there is the colloquium by John Preskill on what is it on? Yeah, but what is the particular?
Quantum cryptography. The seminar itself is at 4 down in the low building next to Goethe, but Cookies and Tea are served on the third floor in Goethe itself, so at around 3:30.
I see. Now, where is Goethe?
Around the back of the there's a construction project on something, a building that's white and green. You go past that building on your left, and you come into sort of a bay area and the six-story building, that's where
I see.
Even though we almost take a different route to lunch and back every day, we almost always go
past by that.
And the seminar room, or the colloquium room, is on the other far side of the corridor.
I see. No, what you said is about the colloquium. Right. No, the seminar is on 33 something.
That's right. That's right. On the third floor, which is also where tea and cookies are served.
Right. Okay, so if you come to the seminar, you will have a reconnaissance trip already under your belt about the cookies later on.